speak sensibly in French. Shall we be having tea today? The English always have tea. We have beer, said Giles. But Will, my father, bought tea bags. I'll put on the kettle, shall I? It was all a bit like the Mad Hatter's tea party. Thomas sat on my knee, and Celeste and Giles arrived with the teapot and water in a china jug, and after tea, which passed in reasonable comfort, Thomas, sucking on a ginger snap and watching everything eagerly, suddenly reached out and pointed at Giles. Giles put out a hand, and Thomas grabbed it, still holding the biscuit in his other wet, crumbed one, and slid off Florence's lap and stood, slightly wobbly, looking up at Giles, grinning, offering the biscuit, and then drew it away. Quietly, wordlessly, they walked slowly down the steps of the terrace onto the path. "I think he quite likes me," said Giles, almost to himself, but loud enough for us to hear. Madame Prudeau was smiling, holding her cup above the saucer. "Children are much wiser than we are. Look at those two. Such trust." Florence said, her eyes still on the tableau before her, "I think he must know that you are his cousin, Giles, isn't it?" Madame Prudeau set her cup and saucer down, slowly got to her feet, brushing crumbs from her creased skirt. "Can I look at the house?" At the cars, Giles held on to Thomas, who was about to scream with fury at the end of his afternoon, but Florence opened doors and Thomas and Celeste were pushed into the back. Madame Prideaux was pulling on her gloves. "The house seems to me that it is smiling again. Get rid of all those canvases up in the A-loft. Then you will have a very splendid room." We shook hands and she got into her car and began to back in a rather alarming way down to the turning place. "Oh, she's not very good at it," said Giles. "There's a huge rusty bash in her mudguard." So Giles had noticed it too.
And tomorrow, William will finally discover the truth about James's disappearance. Dirk Bogart was reading from his own novel Jericho. It was abridged by Neville Teller. The producer was Janet Whittaker.
The Digital Station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
And now we begin a new reading for Afternoons this week. Constable in Love by Martin Gayford. Based on the correspondence between the painter, John Constable, and the love of his life, Maria Bicknell, this account, published in 2010, charts the relationship between love and money alongside its impact on the making of one of our greatest landscape painters. The reader is Anton Lesser.
"My dear sir," Maria Bicknell began, "his only objection would be on the score of that necessary article, cash." Her father's reservation, though merely financial, was fundamental. "What can we do? To live without it is impossible. It would be involving ourselves in misery instead of felicity. Could we but find this golden treasure, we might yet be happy. You say it is not impossible. I wish I had it, but wishes are vain. We must be wise and leave off a correspondence that is not calculated to make us think less of each other. We have many painful trials required of us in this life, and we must learn to bear them with resignation. They could still," she added, "like innumerable young women through the ages, be friends." She was writing to her suitor, a little-known painter named John Constable, on the 4th of November, 1811, while staying at the house of her half-sister, Mrs. Sarah Ski, in Worcestershire. The house, a mansion named Spring Grove, had been built by Mrs. Ski's father-in-law. It had a porch with Ionic pilasters, and within a handsome curving staircase, surmounted by a domed octagon. Outside there was a conservatory where oranges and lemons grew in profusion, Beyond were 270 acres of grounds with a lake, adroitly placed clumps of trees and serpentine paths. Altogether, Spring Grove was striking evidence of the wealth and comfort that a good marriage could bring. Mrs. Ski lived in this delightful place because it had belonged to her late husband. The evidence was visible all around. Mrs. Ski had married very well indeed. Maria's letter concerned the opposite state of affairs, the difficulty of marrying without money. John Constable had been courting her for 2 years, and she had fallen in love with him, with the only result that her parents had sent her to stay here in Worcestershire, safely out of his way. Recently, a letter had arrived from Constable, whom she had not seen for months and never corresponded with at all. This was a clear invitation to resume their relationship and, indeed, to move it decisively forward. To exchange letters with a man was, as everyone knew, implicitly to accept him as a lover. It was a step on the path to the altar. Maria's dilemma was clear. Her heart urged her to write back and keep on writing, but prudence and her sense of duty to her parents, who were firmly against this attachment, argued that she should not. It was often noted during the Georgian era that the British were unusual in their approach to love and marriage. The unexpected thing about them, noted by numerous foreign visitors, was that they so often married for love. In his fable Rasselas, written in 1759, Dr. Johnson described the normal procedure. A youth or maiden, meeting by chance, or brought together by artifice, exchange dances, reciprocate civilities, go home and dream of one another. Finding themselves uneasy when apart, Johnson observed, "They conclude that they should be happy together." The process the great lexicographer outlined was, of course, what is usually termed falling in love, and it sounds commonplace enough, but it wasn't at all usual in the rest of Europe for love to be combined with marriage. Outsiders thought it peculiar that the two should go together in this way. The German novelist Sophie von La Roche noted in 1784, as a feature of the country, along with the rain and the roast beef, that so many love matches are made in England. The Duc de La Rochefoucauld, a French aristocrat staying in England, was surprised to discover that English husbands and wives were always to be seen together and seemed to enjoy each other's company. Across the Channel, where Roman law ruled, the choice of spouse was ultimately a matter for the fathers of the bride and groom. In Britain, legally at any rate, it was a matter for the man and woman involved, so long as they were over 21. Dr. Johnson pronounced that a father had no right to control the inclinations of his daughter in marriage, or to be precise, that he had an entitlement only to influence. The parent's moral right can arise only from his kindness, and his civil right only from his money. Here was the nub of the case of Maria Bicknell. Her father had not told her that she could not marry John Constable. He had merely said that he thought it was a bad idea himself, because that suitor had no money. He, Charles Bicknell, could not or would not provide enough for Maria and Constable to live a comfortable life. Maria did not think it likely that her father would change his mind. So there was no more to be done. Constable responded, "I had better not write to you any more, at least till I can coin. We should both of us be bad subjects for poverty, should we not? Even painting would go badly. It could not survive in domestic worry." Their courtship had begun 2 years before, when Constable was 33 and Maria 21, but its progress had been slow. Constable had first set eyes on Maria when she was only 12. They were both members, at least intermittently, of the same community. East Burgholt, a large village on the brow of a low hill above the River Stour. According to the 1800 census, 970 people lived there, but John Constable and Maria Bicknell were part of the much smaller group, a few dozen at most, of wealthy and prominent inhabitants. Maria's grandfather, The Reverend Dr. Duran Rudd was the rector of the parish, and Maria came to stay with her grandparents, partly perhaps because her health was fragile and the clear air of Suffolk was expected to do her good. She was a favourite of her grandfather's, and that affection had a surprisingly crucial effect on her romance with Constable. In Georgian England, there was considerable social mobility. It was possible to ascend quite rapidly through energy, good fortune and enterprise, as Golding Constable John's father had, and just as easy to slip down again. John Constable was living on an allowance of £100 a year, provided rather against his better judgment by his father, plus any small fees that he might earn from painting, and these to date were meagre and infrequent. This was sufficient to maintain him in a moderately comfortable bachelor existence in lodgings in London, especially as he often spent several months of the year at home in Suffolk. It was not enough to maintain a wife, though, let alone a family, in a genteel manner. From Maria's point of view, both marriage and spinsterhood involved hazards. To become the wife of a husband with insufficient income risked poverty for oneself and one's children, and the prospect of an indigent widowhood, not all that unlikely if the husband were a dozen years older, as Constable was. On the other hand, the prospects for an unmarried middle-class woman were also bleak. Maria came from an era of greater female education, which was widely, if not universally, agreed to be a great improvement to society. It was indeed exactly what made the marriage of intellectual equals a possibility. Unfortunately, there was little work available for them to do with these educated minds, and the possibilities that did exist were not attractive. Not surprisingly, despite all the pitfalls, Georgian women were, on the whole, keen to get married. It was obvious, even from the letter in which she told him that they must be just friends, that Maria loved John Constable. There was, however, an unusual complicating factor in the situation: art. Everything was made more difficult by Constable's determination to be a painter. By his own account, Constable had mused about painting long before he had actually begun to do it. This wish to become an artist was connected with the emotions he felt for a particular place, his own village and the landscape around the banks of the River Stour. This river, which forms the border between Suffolk and Essex, winds between low hills for the last few miles of its course before reaching its estuary. This area, the parishes of East Burgholt, Dedham, Stratford St Mary, Langham and Nayland, are what eventually became known as Constable Country. Constable knew he painted his own places best. By that he meant most of all a small area around the watermill at Flatford that was his father's property. "These lowland riverside scenes," Constable wrote, "made me a painter, and I am grateful that I had often thought of pictures of them before I ever touched a brush." It is not clear how Constable even came to know of painting as an activity. Certainly there was no precedent for it in the Constable family. His father, Golding, was a successful corn merchant, miller and coal transporter. He had inherited the watermill at Flatford from an uncle and steadily built up the business. Golding was a local figure of note. He was director of the workhouse at Tattingston, which he happened to supply with corn and wheat, and had bought East Burgholt House and a family pew in the parish church. Golding Constable's rise was recent and rapid enough to attract the jealousy of another proud, self-made man, the rector, Maria's grandfather, Reverend Dr. Duran Rudd. Golding's financial position had large implications for his son John, both as an aspiring artist and a would-be married man. The Constables were a little too well off for their son to consider art as a profession. In England, painters had only recently risen from the ranks of artisans. Now, a few, preeminently Joshua Reynolds, had achieved the rank and income of gentlemen. Still, it was far from being an obvious career for the son of a prosperous man. When it became clear that John had no appetite for the necessary studies required of a man of the cloth, he went instead into the family business for a while. He continued to help his father for several years while pressing to be allowed to become a painter. Eventually, when the youngest of the Constable's sons, Abram, 7 years John's junior, showed an aptitude for the trades of milling grain and transporting coal, John was reluctantly allowed to begin his artistic training at the Royal Academy Schools in London. This was not, however, until early 1799, when he was almost 24. His father thought then that he was pursuing a shadow, and nothing had happened to change that view a decade later, when Constable wrote to Dr. Reverend Rudd's granddaughter, Maria Bicknell. Constable's financial and social background had a crucial effect on his attitude to art. It gave him a sense of independence. He painted because he wanted to, not because he had to, and as far as possible, he painted what he wanted to. In this, he resembled later artists, such as Cézanne or Van Gogh, eccentric middle-class mavericks, both of them, like Constable. He worked for money on occasion, but always grudgingly. His real aim was reputation rather than profit or immediate popularity. This was one of the attitudes that made Constable a distinctively modern artist. There were, however, severe limitations to his independence. Golding Constable could afford to keep two sons in idleness, Golding Jr. and John, plus two daughters who remained at home. What he could not do was support a son with little or no income, plus a wife and an unknown number of children. Quixotic and uncontrollable in the matter of marriage as he had been over his choice of career, John ignored these practicalities.
Anton Lesser was reading Constable in Love by Martin Gayford. It was abridged by Lou Kemp and produced by Jill Waters. And at 3:15 tomorrow, we'll hear of the young lover's courtship.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3:00. Hello, I'm Zeb Soans, and we've a classic tale of a noble deed and its reward in this hour, based on the classic fable The Mouse and the Lion. There's something fishy going on in the 4:00 show this afternoon, as Mel presents an exclusive adaptation of David Arman's book The Boy Who Swam with Piranhas. And we'll get a behind-the-scenes look at the circus. That's all in an hour. First on 4 Extra, our drama has roots in a folktale that dates back to the Middle Ages, when it appeared as The Shepherd and the Lion. But it's probably more familiar as Aesop's fable of the Lion and the Mouse. In this version, published in 1912, George Bernard Shaw transforms the hero into a Greek tailor who comes to the aid of a fearsome beast.
Androcles and the Lion.
We are in a jungle, and along a path in this jungle, a lion comes limping on three legs, holding up his right forepaw, in which a huge thorn sticks. He sits down and contemplates it. He licks it. Tears drop from his eyes. He limps painfully off the path and lies down under the trees, exhausted with pain. He goes to sleep. Androcles and his wife Megara come along the path. He's a small, thin, ridiculous little man who might be any age from 30 to 55. He carries a big bundle, is very poorly clad, and seems tired and hungry. His wife is a rather handsome, pampered slattern, well-fed and in the prime of life.
I won't go another step.
Oh, not again, dear. What's the good of stopping every 2 miles and saying you won't go another step? We must get on to the next village before night. There are wild beasts in this wood. Lions, they say.
I don't believe a word of it. You don't care how tired I am or what becomes of me. You're always thinking of yourself. Self, self, self. Always yourself.
We all have to think of ourselves occasionally, dear.
A man ought to think about his wife sometimes.
He can't always help it, dear. You make me think of you a good deal. Not that I blame you.
Blame me? I should think not indeed. Is it my fault that I'm married to you?
No, dear. That is my fault.
That's a nice thing to say to me. Aren't you happy with me?
I don't complain, my love.
Then why don't you treat me properly and be a good husband to me?
What can I do, my dear?
What can you do? You can return to your duty and come back to your home and friends and sacrifice to the gods as all respectable people do. Instead of having us hunted out of house and home for being dirty, disreputable, blaspheming atheists?
I'm not an atheist, dear. I'm a Christian.
Well, isn't that the same thing? Only 10 times worse. Everybody knows that the Christians are the very lowest of the low.
Just like us, dear.
Speak for yourself. Don't you dare compare me to common people. My father owned his own public house, and sorrowful was the day for me when you first came drinking in our bar.
I confess I was addicted to it, dear, but I gave it up when I became a Christian.
You'd much better have remained a drunkard. What I can't stand is your being addicted to Christianity. And what's worse again, you're being addicted to animals. How is any woman to keep her house clean?